It's the time of the week for adventure, the time of the week to leave planet Earth and explore the universe all around us. It's time for a brand new Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name is Dan, thanks for being there. This is where we search out all the science secrets lurking through the solar system and even further beyond. This week we'll chat to scientist and author Patrick Kane about his new book, Human 2.0. It's all about the amazing inventions that can help people with missing limbs.
Learning about how long prosthetic limbs and prostheses have been around for was fascinating. So they found mummies in Egyptian tombs that have prosthetic limbs on them.
And we'll head to Deep Space High to learn why humans are so desperate to get to Mars.
There are lots of reasons or clues to think there might be life on Mars. Who can remember any of the clues?
Well, even though it's colder than Earth, it's not too freezing or too hot for humans to survive there. And if humans could, maybe other life could too.
And I've got your questions to answer. Love it when you send your questions to me so I can do the science digging. This week they are on bald men and dinosaurs. Quite a combination. It's all happening in our brand new Fun Kids Science Weekly. Let's start with this week's Science in the News. A hole that's 30 times the size of Earth has spread across the sun, which sounds quite worrying, doesn't it? A hole in the sun. It'll blast solar winds across our planet. They travel at 800 kilometres a second, but these winds are quite harmless, and they could lead to a very bright and vibrant northern lights, which is amazing. If you get a chance to see the Aurora Borealis in the north of the world, the stunning stripes that light up the sky, it's all to do with solar winds and how the sun's radiation hits our atmosphere. And this will really help that, which is brilliant. And it's not a proper hole. It's just a patch of cooler temperature that spreads across the sun. Also, the James Webb Space Telescope has seen a raging dust storm on a planet outside of the solar system for the first time. It's about 40 light years from Earth. The dust storm is made by rocky mist made of small grains of tiny rock-like particles. And this shows, doesn't it, how incredible this telescope is. For the last year, we've spoken about the huge telescope. It's up in space. Its job is to look at the oldest stars in the universe. And we're getting closer to finding them. And finally, the world's first 3D rocket has blasted off. Relativity Space is made in America, and it managed to get off the ground, but it did fail to actually reach space, so experts are now figuring out how to make it powerful enough to blast through the atmosphere later on. It's amazing, isn't it? It's not easy, 3D printing, but how much simpler the techniques that we have for making science that years ago would have been seen as mind-blowingly impossible. And we can do it now with a 3D printer. It's time to spin the wheel of the A to Z of engineering then. Every week at the moment, we are learning about a different part of engineering. How things are made, what they're made of, who makes them. We're going right the way through the alphabet, from A's acoustics all the way through to Z zoos. We're doing that with the help of Engers. He is our engineering expert, and he kicks us off every week by spinning the wheel to find out what letter we're on this week.
Hello and welcome to another Engineering Academy, where we're exploring an A to Z of everything engineering. Let's spin the wheel and see where we're engineering today. Over to Engers to spin the wheel.
It's Q, and Q is for quality.
Every organisation, wherever they are, is engaged in quality engineering, whether they know it or not. The very act of creating a product or providing a service involves wrestling with a challenge of delivering high quality. Because ignoring quality has almost always led to disastrous results. Let's find out more from Engers.
Now, you probably know what we mean by quality. It's all to do with how good something is, and we generally want things to be the very best they can. Quality is something right at the heart of engineering. If you look around where you are, you'll see engineering and engineered objects everywhere. From roads and structures to the appliances, technology, and clothes we use every day. Engineering creates products, machinery, and systems that solve problems. And the better quality these things are, the better the problems will be solved. So what does a quality engineer do? Basically, they validate products for suitability, performance, and safety. Suitability means, does it do the job? Performance, is it doing the best job possible? And safety is, well, is it safe to use? Safety is a really important factor. If you think about it, for medical equipment like pacemakers, which regulate a patient's heartbeat, poor quality could result in injury or even death. Likewise, a new high-tech material, however fashionable and warm, is no good if it easily catches fire. Quality engineers are involved right from the start of any new manufacturing process. They will analyze processes, test materials at the beginning and created products during manufacturing, and again before anything is released for public use to make sure they work as expected. Companies have standards and specifications for the performance and quality of their products, some of which may be required by law. When defects are spotted, they will report them as soon as possible so they can be resolved quickly and efficiently. After all, if problems are left too long, they can be harder to fix, which costs time and money. Quality engineers aren't just involved in physical products. You'll find them in almost every area of technology, including software, like when developing programs that run self-service checkouts in supermarkets.
Unexpected item in bagging area.
Engineers will test user interfaces to ensure they not only register sales and take payment, but are also easy to understand and use. When there's a software upgrade, they'll check to make sure any changes don't introduce bugs to old features. Feedback from customers is often useful to make improvements. They'll also use something called statistical analysis to help identify defects and problems. That's a way of getting an overview of things, predicting where weaknesses may be, and how problems can most efficiently be resolved. Let's take another example. Wind turbines. When designing a new wind turbine, quality engineers will work closely with suppliers to ensure turbine parts and components are perfect, produced exactly to their product specifications. They not only help with the manufacturing process, ensuring all blueprints and legal requirements are met, but will also help determine if a proposed site is acceptable and identify any problems that could impact the quality of operation. For example, extremes of weather on a hillside or out at sea. Once in operation, quality engineers will oversee maintenance of the turbines, making sure that repairs are done properly and analyze problems to see if they could be resolved in the manufacturing process. All of this with the aim of getting the best, most efficient, highest performing, and safe turbine to provide our energy.
Thanks, Engers. And that's our take on the letter Q. It's been, well, top quality. If you'd like to check out some other types of engineering, why not check out Quarry or even Quantum Engineering?
Engineer Academy, created with support from the Royal Academy of Engineering. If you would like to find out more about the A to Z, visit funkinslive.com/engineer.
Let's get to your questions then. If you've ever got a science question that you want answered on the show, it's really easy to let me know about it. Get to funkidslive.com. Find our page on there. There's a big record button. Click it, say your name, and then ask away. I will see it, and I can't wait to do the science digging to find out what's happening with your question. Who's first this week?
Hi, I'm Luke. My question is, why do men go bald when they get older?
Thank you for this question, Luke. Why do men go bald? Generally because of a common condition, quite common, called androgenic alopecia. You might know it by another name that you've heard. Maybe you've heard your dad shouting it at the mirror. Male pattern baldness. It's an inherited condition passed down through your family. It's in the genes. Experts don't really know why it really only affects men. There are a few ideas why it could be helpful in evolution. Perhaps when you get old, your body needs to focus its energy on other things, getting weaker, so it sheds its hair to give it less to concentrate on. That's one idea, but nobody really knows why only men have grown this trait of androgenic alopecia, male pattern baldness. But it's passed down in your genes, so at a certain time in your life, if it's in your genes, your body will say, I don't want to grow any more hair on my head. That's pretty much what happens, Luke. Thank you very much for the question. Who's next?
Hi, my name is Nolan. I am 5 years old, and I want to know why Are some dinosaurs meat eaters, fearless, and some are plant eaters, not fearless?
Well, did you know many more dinosaurs, Nolan, were herbivores, plant eaters, than carnivores? This is because, very simply, there were lots of plants around. Evolution, which we speak about all the time on the show, it means that creatures did well and thrived and had more chance of keeping their species going if they were more equipped for the environment around them. So if you could eat plants that grew naturally on the floor, as opposed to waiting for a prey to catch, you stood a good chance of surviving and thriving. Thing is, meat was easier to digest. If you're a big animal, you need things from meat that you can't get from plants, and you need a lot of energy. What makes more sense if you're huge, eating thousands of plants every minute of the day, or you find some big prey maybe once or twice a week? What would take less time? Well, experts know that dinosaurs were either carnivores or herbivores because of teeth fossils. They found them and they can show what the teeth were made for slicing and cutting or for chewing and grinding. Some had very sharp ones for meat. Others had flat, thick ones to help break down the plants. And the few had both of them, like we do, omnivores. We can really eat anything. And that is why some dinosaurs ate meat and some ate plants. Thank you very much for your questions this week. There is a bonus episode of the Science Weekly available on Fun Kids Podcasts Plus, where we do nothing but answer your questions. So if you want to get involved to hear some more brilliant answers, to have another chance for your question to get answered, actually, subscribe to Fun Kids Podcasts Plus. You can try it for free over on Apple Podcasts and at funkidslive.com. Let's get to this week's Dangerous Dan, where we look at some of the most mean and cruel and wicked and amazing things in the universe. This week, we're taking a look at the most massive star in the universe. Now, it's not got a catchy name, but it's huge, which makes up for it. It's called RMC-136A1. Now, here's what's mind-blowing. It's 300 times the mass of the Sun, so it's heavier than the Sun. But, strangely, it's only 30 times as big. So the numbers don't quite match up. What that means is it's got a lot of stuff crammed inside it. You'll find RMC-136A1 in the large Magellanic Cloud Galaxy. It's right in the heart of the Tarantula Nebula, which is one of the brightest range of stars in the sky. Now, it's not just massive, but it's also the brightest star that we know of. It's thought to be maybe a million years old. It's got burning hydrogen packed into its core. It's surrounded by loads of heavy elements. It has winds blowing off it that can blow as fast as 5.8 million miles an hour. Just imagine this chunky, heavy beast whipping those stellar winds across the universe. It's the most massive star that we know about, which is why it goes straight onto our Dangerous Dan list. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. This week, we're looking at the body, the human body, seeing how it's changing and how it might change more with technology in the future. You see, there's a brand new book all about this. It's called Human 2.0. It's written by Patrick Kane, who joins us now. Patrick, thank you for being there.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Now, when you first had the idea for this book, looking at the amazing science that's changed what our human body can do, where did you start? What was the very first thing that you remember looking up?
Well, to be completely honest, I myself have a bionic arm and a prosthetic leg. And so for me, learning how that technology worked was something I did on the day that I first got this technology. And it's something that I've obviously explained to people a lot and talk about a lot. So I started with what I have, and then I became curious to learn more about everything else.
With your bionic arm and the prosthetic leg, how much are you thinking about the future of that, the different types of technology that maybe could change how you can use your leg and your arm?
I think about that all the time. And I think for me, it's been so interesting seeing, even over the course of my life, I was the youngest person in the world to be fitted with a bionic arm. And in the 13 years since then, the technology's only got better and better. And I keep seeing new things coming out for arms, for legs, for eyes, for ears. So I think it's a really exciting time now, because also we're entering a place where we might create prosthetic devices and bionic limbs for people who aren't missing a limb. And so people might get a third arm or maybe a set of wings. So it's a really exciting time to be alive.
Oh, that's amazing. I want to talk about the future in just a second. Let's run through some of the incredible things that you found out for this book. So in your research, what bits of technology have you found for the body that really opened your mind and changed everything?
Well, I think in my research, I, at a very early stage, learning about how long prosthetic limbs and prostheses have been around for was fascinating. So they found mummies in Egyptian tombs that have prosthetic limbs on them. Learning then how that technology got a bit better over the years and when they sort of went from being made out of wood to metals and then to some of the more modern materials we use today. That was really interesting. But I think as well for me, learning about how all of these devices have sort of come to be real. So whether that's after certain points in history, things were developed or certain breakthroughs that happened when then people realized, hang on, we could use this to make a really small motor, which then would have an impact on an arm. Or it's just been really interesting to see how the evolution happened. And sunglasses have been around for such a long time with sort of tinted rocks being used as lenses. It's just fascinating to think how old some of this technology is, but also how much it's still developing.
Talking about things still developing, how much do we know about where prostheses might end up in, say, 10, 20, 30 years? Do scientists, do doctors, do designers know what they want to make, but maybe we haven't quite got the technology? You mentioned wings earlier. Have we got any idea about what's to come?
I think the only limit is our own imagination, to be honest. I think there's so many exciting things. I think that we are trying to currently replicate what we were already missing and what already exists. So a lot of the current research is going into arms, legs, eyes and ears, because that's what can help people who might have a disability and who are missing them. But there are definitely some future leaning scientists out there who are focusing specifically on maybe things that we don't all have. So there's one scientist who is creating shoes that sort of make you run faster, which sort of make the load easier on your legs. But I think it's natural that we're seeing some of these really exciting things coming, because it's hard for people to not, you know, dream and get excited about this amazing tech.
Is there a part of you that worries about that, though? The perhaps if we can have any prostheses that we want, we can almost design our body to so much that it might be harmful to us and maybe harmful to society. How worried are you about that sometimes?
I wouldn't say I'm worried about anything yet, because I think that there's such an important job to be done to help restore function from people who've lost limbs and who have disabilities if they want help. But I would say that as this technology gets better and better, we are going to have to start to answer these questions. But I think first and foremost, sort of the right thing to do is to create this technology, and then we can work out how, if a line should be drawn. But to be honest, I think that the potential is so exciting, and you know, whether that's for someone to get a second arm back or someone who doesn't have a disability to get a third arm to help them performing some of their chores, I think is too exciting to not explore.
With the book Human 2.0, you've worked on this with the illustrator Sam Rodriguez. Just talk us through what the book's like. What can we see? How have you shown all these fantastic inventions and what might happen in the future in the book?
So Sam Rodriguez is an artist, but I consider him more of a wizard. The work that he's made is so beautiful, and you have these really vivid, bright, colourful drawings which sort of highlight some of the technology when it's on a person, or maybe break it down so you can really see some of the inner workings of things. There's a page on how pacemakers work, and you kind of see under the skin of someone who has a pacemaker and see where it sits on their heart. But then you also see the intricate working inside a bionic arm. So Sam has done an amazing job of really bringing the words to life. And I think that obviously we want everyone to be able to read this, but also I think you can learn a huge amount just from how detailed the imagery really is. So I'd urge everyone to look it up and see that I'm telling the truth.
From everything that you learned while writing this book, from cochlear implants, which help people hear, pacemakers, which keep our hearts ticking over and beating, bionic arms and legs, what was your favourite part of the whole writing a book? What was the favourite thing that you learned while you were making this?
I think the key thing wasn't in any one specific section, but it was really that all of this technology is only as good as the people who use them. And so for me, it was so fascinating to learn that, okay, a bionic arm might change the way that someone interacts with the world, but it may also give them the confidence to do that and the belief that they should do that. So for me, that was really interesting seeing, and it's no coincidence the title is Human 2.0, because humanity and people is at the core of this story. And so I'd have to say that learning how important the people are behind the technology has been the real eye-opener.
Amazing. The book is stunning. There's so much to learn in there, and it's a real eye-opener, as you say. It's Patrick Kane, illustrated by Sam Rodriguez. The book is Human 2.0. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's head to Deep Space High, the smartest school in the solar system, to finish this week's episode off. For the last few weeks, we've been getting lessons from Professor Pulsar up there. He knows everything about the universe, and the best part is Deep Space High, it's got loads of windows all over the place. They have brilliant views of all the planets around the solar system. One of them is Mars. And this week, Professor Pulsar is explaining to us why Mars fascinates Earthlings. It might be able to sustain life. Life might already be there, and there's a new mission that hopes to find out more.
Deep Space High, destination Mars.
Jump into your wormhole and travel to Deep Space High. The school is space. But hurry, because lessons are about to begin.
So, we've seen that Mars is a pretty interesting place, and Earthlings are certainly very excited about it. Can anyone tell me why?
Is it because there might be aliens there?
That's right. Although from all the probes and robots that have been sent there, we know that there aren't any three-headed monsters. Well, not that we've seen. I wasn't talking about you, Quark. But yes, there are lots of reasons or clues to think there might be life on Mars. Who can remember any of the clues?
Well, even though it's colder than Earth, it's not too freezing or too hot for humans to survive there. And if humans could, maybe other life could too.
Exactly right. After Earth, Mars is the most Earth-like planet in the solar system. It's in something called the Goldilocks zone. It's close enough to the sun to be able to sustain life, not too hot that any life is just blasted away, and not too cold that there's not enough energy for life forms to survive. Any other clues? Anyone? Okay, I'll give you a clue.
It's water.
That's right. The possibility of running water on Mars is a clue that there might be life. We can see patterns in the rock and dark stripes across the land that suggest there were rivers once. And maybe that water is still there, under the surface of the planet. There's another substance that's been found on the planet.
Chocolate?
Nothing so tasty. Well, not for Earth children. It's methane. Methane is a special gas that can be a sign of organic activity. Quark, that is not a special gas.
So why don't Earthlings send some astronauts up there to have a proper look around?
Funnily enough, that is exactly what's planned. A very exciting project called the Aurora Programme is underway. It will send a special robot to Mars called the ExoMars Rover in a special mission to determine if life exists or ever existed on the red planet. NASA and the European Space Agency are working together on developing robots to probe the planet like never before and provide unprecedented data on the history and composition of this fascinating world.
Awesome! Will any human astronauts go with them?
Not at first. Before humans can set foot on Mars, scientists need to know as much as possible about the red planet. What are the dangers to human explorers? How easy is it to live and work on Mars?
And if there's any other special gases?
They'll be fairly easy to find if any exist. The ExoMars rover mission will be followed by a further mission in the 2020s, which will provide data for a planned human mission in the 2030s.
Wow, a human mission. Astronauts on Mars. Hey, in 2030, I'll be a grown-up. Maybe I could lead the mission.
Yes, and get this, kids. There will be Earth children in school right now who might walk on Mars as part of that mission. Exciting stuff, right?
That's so cool. So what will the ExoMars rover be able to do?
Well, the ExoMars rovers will use the very latest technology. Panoramic cameras with enhanced zoom, infrared spectrometers and organic molecule analyzers to test samples. it'll have more gadgets than stats.
No one has more gadgets than me. Not even on a planet as cool as Mars.
Deep Space High, Destination Mars. Support from the UK Space Agency. Find out more at funkidslive.com/space.
And that is it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much to Patrick Kane for coming on the show. And thank you to you for your science questions. If there is anything that you want answered on this show next week, send it as a voice note to me over at funkidslive.com. You can do it on the free Fun Kids app too. And remember, we've got a brand new bonus episode of this show out with just your questions, which you can listen to on Fun Kids Podcasts Plus. Now, if you've enjoyed any of the shows you've heard so far today, we've had the A to Z of Engineering and Deep Space High. You can listen on Google, Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your shows. They're on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com. And Fun Kids, we are a children's radio station from the UK. Listen all over the country on your DAB digital radio and at funkidslive.com.